Right, okay. My name's Michael Pidd, and I work for the University of Sheffield, and I run this place, the Humanities Research Institute, and we specialise in providing technology, support and development services for research in the arts and humanities, and increasingly the heritage sector. In the past, we've worked on projects such as the Old Bailey Proceedings, which people might have heard about. Today I'm going to talk about a JISC-funded project we're just coming to the end of. It's called Connected Histories. I think it was an 18-month project, and we're due to deliver at the end of this month, in fact. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to talk about federated searching, particularly the practicalities of it and the lessons that we've learned within the context of this specific project. So the idea behind Connected Histories is to provide a single point of access to a wealth of history content that's currently on the web. These are typically small to large data sets owned by public or commercial content providers, and the idea is to provide a single point of access and to enable structured searching across all of these data sets. By structured searching, I mean the ability to be able to search for specific people, places, dates, that sort of thing. So these are the data sets that we set out to deliver. As you can see, there's quite a variety on there. British History Online, which is one of the de facto points of call for the historians. A few data sets that we own in Sheffield, Old Bailey Proceedings, Plebeian Lives. And obviously there's a mixture of, as I said earlier, commercial and data sets that are licensed through commercial content providers. Most notably, we've got ProQuest and Gale Cengage data sets, but also smaller organic companies such as the Origins Network. Quite a varied collection of data sets in terms of scale and format. We've got traditional databases on there. We've got XML encoded data, and when I say encoded, I mean sort of structured data of quite varying degrees. And of course, we've got an awful lot of unstructured data, predominantly the data that's being delivered by Gale and ProQuest, such as the British Library's newspapers and the parliamentary papers. I've put up these estimations of size. It's been one of the really challenging things with this project, trying to work out how big this project is actually going to be, and that's obviously quite critical in terms of planning the infrastructure and the delivery. But as I'll touch upon shortly, that's been a sort of a real challenge. So, from the user's point of view, the purpose of Connected Histories is to provide structured searching and a single point of access and enhanced functionality. From the content provider's perspective, we were hoping to achieve to be able to deliver to them a new way of accessing their data, a new form of marketing for their data, and also we wanted to provide them with a solution for giving people enhanced access to their data, but in a way that didn't require them to actually do anything, okay? Because we take the view that particularly for commercial content providers, they're in the business of making money, and we'll leave them to carry on doing what they do, as long as they'll support us in what we're wanting to achieve on our project. So before I go any further, it's really key to understand the relationship between the partners on this project, because it's reflected in the architecture. So there are two key partners. There's the HRI in Sheffield, and then there's the Institute for Historical Research at Senate House in London. Now, here I'm referring to them as Sheffield and London, because the confusion between HRI and IHR is it gets, particularly since they've decided to brand themselves as IHR Digital, which is a little bit naughty. So it seemed really important to understand that all of the data will reside on the Sheffield server, but the user interface, the website that you visit, will be on the London server. So when a user conducts a search, they're conducting a search on the London server, and that website sends the query to us in Sheffield, at which point, usually on a postcard, at which point we sort of go away and look up the answer. The query arrives in Sheffield. The indexes are based on the Sheffield server, so we do the search at our end, and then we send the results back to London, and their server renders the results on the website. So there's that interchange between the two locations taking place. When a user gets a result, they're given a short bit of metadata and a snippet, an idea of what's in that document. When they want to, that's displayed via the London server. When they want to visit an actual result, they click on the link and they go through to the document on the live website that's hosted by the actual content provider. The key thing about that is that it means that we don't have to replicate all the visual aspects of their data, and more importantly, it enables us to honour their subscription gateways where those gateways exist. So for example, with ProQuest or Cengage, you can do, if you and your institution are not signed up to, say, the ProQuest products, you can do all of this on Connected Histories for free. You can see all of the results, but when you click through to a ProQuest document, it's at that point that you'll then need to have your sort of subscription details, and obviously you can't go any further if you're not already subscribed. So with the project, so in terms of delivering this project, that's all the content. How do we? So I'm going to talk to you now about how we actually get the content into delivered through that architecture. And this basically summarizes the process. So we acquire data from the content provider. I'm going to tell you more about each of these. We conduct a technical audit of the data. We apply some techniques called natural language processing in order to add value to the data. We go through an evaluation process to basically assess the extent to which the natural language processing has been successful, generate the indexes, etc., and upload the data to our servers. Meanwhile, working with London, we've had to put in place a protocol that enables that communication between the two servers to take place, and we've done sort of the more sort of standard processes of developing the actual search query, having endless debates about what historians will want to and general users will want to search for, and I should emphasise with that we've done an awful lot of focus group work, and we've gone through sort of the process of developing the search interface and other features. So if I'm just going to sort of go through those then, and essentially highlight what some of the challenges have been for us. Acquiring data from the content providers seems a relatively simple thing to do. It was actually, in some respects, it was the more challenging part of the project, and from our perspective, it was the one that we felt was the most riskiest, because if these people sign up in principle, prior to you submitting your application to the JISC, but then obviously once you've had the funding awarded, you've then got to sit down and go through the detail with them, and it's then that it comes home to them, particularly the commercial providers, what they're letting themselves in for. Fortunately, they were sort of quite amenable towards us, actually. So we managed to achieve all that through a process of setting up licenses that essentially dictated what we could and couldn't do with their data. Data that was held within the public domain, that was all sort of pretty straightforward.
whereas data that was held by commercial providers, there are issues such as we're limited as to the extent that we can comment upon the quality of their data. There's a lot of concerns about us about me not standing up here and telling you whether I thought that their data was any good or not. And we also have to bear in mind that that with connected histories, some of these providers, particularly ProQuest and Gale, one could consider them to be competitors. So we've had to have everything put down in writing. But that seems to be sort of working okay, and they seem to be sort of quite willing partners. Once we'd done that, it was then sort of basically acquiring the data, and to be honest, physically acquiring the data. And to be honest, that has been the most challenging part of the whole project. Actually moving that amount of data from one location to another. Originally with this project, this was in the bid to the JISC, we had this great idea that we were going to develop a web crawler, and this web crawler would go to all of these sites, download these data sets, and then every 6 months we just sort of ask the web crawler to go out and do it again to check whether or not any of the data had been altered. In practice, we realised that wasn't possible for two reasons. The first was that we sort of suspected at the outset that certainly the commercial providers weren't happy about the idea of a web crawler wandering around their servers. And secondly, there's a more of a technical issue to do with the fact that a web crawler can only see what is actually delivered by the server. And if we bear in mind that a lot of web services involve taking structured data and then transforming them and rendering them for presentation on this for your browser, you have to recognise that when that takes place, a lot of the structure is actually removed. And it's all turned into sort of like, you know, sort of HTML, so it's made to sort of look visual. So the problem with using a web crawler, we realised, is that we would lose a lot of the structure that we would want to keep to assist us in the processing. So we put the web crawler aside, and we went for the good old fashioned way of acquiring the data, which was that they basically send us the data through the post. So we essentially receive. Shipment after shipment of terabyte drives, and then as I said, the challenging part of the project was actually then moving that data around internally within our organisation. And we're talking about, say, taking over a week to move one data set from either a terabyte drive to a server, or from one server to another. And I spoke to ProQuest and I said, this is a real pain in the butt doing this, moving this stuff around. You know, and they said, yeah, it's funny, we have that problem as well. It's the biggest problem in our organisation. In fact, we virtually have somebody whose full-time job is just moving data around to get it into the places that we want to use it. So that's the acquisition of data. Once we've got the data, we have to do a technical audit. We need to understand what the data is we've been given, because obviously we can't sort of tell that really from the website. What we're seeing that's presented publicly isn't really what's important to us. It's the underlying data structures and the underlying formats. The issues we found in doing the technical audit is trying to establish on a very basic level what constitutes a meaningful unit of data. So, you know, particularly today particularly with some organisations that have like very old databases that have been built over time, so they're not necessarily well designed. Legally, I'm not allowed to tell you which content providers they are. But when you see a web page that has, say, a record on it that's pulled out of an archive, that information can be pulled from lots and lots of different places within a database or within multiple data sources. So when it comes to pointing to data, bearing in mind that when the user's done a search, they want to go to that record, it isn't always clear what you're pointing to. The other issue that's important for the technical audit is identifying the URL, and that seems like a very, very simple thing to want to do, so that, you know, we have persistent URLs so that we know that when the user has seen the result and they want to go and see the document, that's the URL that will bring up that document. It just is not as simple as that. Even with commercial companies such as ProQuest and Cengage, the way in which they handle this is just quite frankly bizarre. They're very different. There's little similarity between the two organisations. And the thing that to this day always I just cannot get my head around is the fact that the persistent, durable URL is often longer than the conventional URL, and we're talking hundreds of characters long, and it's just there's at least one data set in there where we haven't been able to work out how you form the URLs, and the organisation is on the case. They can't work out how they form their URLs either. Then we apply after the audit, we apply the natural language processing. I'll sort of just whiz through this quickly because it's technical. It's very technical, but essentially it's a process called automated entity extraction, and basically it enables you to go through data and identify, in this case, the names of people, places and dates, but it could be concepts, it could be terminology, etc. Our intention with this project was to essentially set up a pipeline process so that we can put the data into the system, apply our NLP algorithms, and then the structured data comes out the other end. And we wanted to do this in such a way that we wouldn't have to keep setting up algorithms, and in terms of taking the project forward, we could just sort of add new data. We could put the new data sets in it and be sort of pretty much like a factory line. We have achieved that. I was really pleased that. In fact, that's been so successful that for the charging model for taking connected histories forward beyond the JISC funding, the time for NLP for developing the NLP algorithms doesn't actually appear in the charging model. It's not we haven't had to factor that in. However, just as we're moving the data, actually processing the data from an NLP point of view, again, is time consuming. We've currently got a data set being processed, and we estimate that it will take a minimum of 27 days for the service to process it. And just quickly, okay. Once we've done our NLP with it, we then generate our indexes. So you've got to imagine that we've having gone through this, having acquired all the data and understood it, and tagged it and identified the names of people and places. We have this data that is essentially more structured than when it was given to us originally, because we've essentially added metadata to it. From that, we then generate our indexes. Now, a big change in the project was originally, this is just like a sort of an overview of the search, but a user will do a search and they can search for either places, people, dates, keyword, or a combination of all of those. Keyword searching is obviously on the full text. What we're originally going to do is we were going to have the full text held in a MySQL database, and all the people, places and data was going to be held in RDF format. We rapidly dropped that because MySQL wasn't able to, certainly within our infrastructure, wasn't able to cope with the volume of data, and likewise we found that the RDF is just too verbose. So with this project, one of the things that really became apparent is that standards are probably very good for communicating with the outside world, for taking data in and for sending data out, but that it's not they're not necessarily ideal for processing internally. So we've moved over to an entirely Lucene solution. Oops. So then finally, this is supposed to be the side, but we have an error message. Having generated the indexes, the other area that's sort of occupied us is developing the search interface and other features, which I seem unable to show you. That was undertaken very much by the IHR in London. and an external visual design company called Mickey and Mallory Limited. That was particularly useful for us because they were able to bring in a lot of commercial expertise as well. And obviously, they've worked. I think they work on quite a few projects for the JISC, but they've obviously they have a lot of experience of developing sites within very different sectors, such as e-commerce. So they're able to bring in a lot of knowledge relating to usability and human computer design. So key issues from our point of view in delivering this project is that it's difficult to predict the vital statistics of this project. When you're dealing with that amount of data and you're having to process it, so there's quite a lot of data we throw away, but there's quite a lot of new data we develop. It's really difficult to get a handle on what the size of the data is going to be and therefore what sort of resource and infrastructure you're going to need to throw at it. Bearing in mind that the ProQuest Parliamentary Papers data set is publicly it's identified as being so many million, a couple of million items. When we've processed it, it's actually 7 million items, so it's like a big difference. Key issue, moving data around, as I've just said, we realised that the big investment for us was kit, not people. So you can have like one person who's sort of running all of this, but you need to surround them with like a sea of kit. And obviously there were the other key issues was the URL and the and identifying a meaningful data unit. So just quickly, very finally, in terms of sustainability, taking connected histories forward, all of that is going to be free. It's free to access, and we've now been working to put together a charging model to take on board further data sets in the future. And these data sets can be sort of, the charging model is essentially intended to make it viable for small data sets being generated as a result of small research projects to be included, as well as larger data sets produced by large organisations such as this one. And the intention is for Connected Histories long term to become the de facto point of access for British historical resources online. And that's me done. Thank you.
I do have a quick question. You mentioned that in the end it wasn't possible to implement the RDF solution for the authority entities and the SQL database for the full text. What did you go for in the end?
We went for Lucene, and there were other advantages with Lucene.
I couldn't understand.
the problem we were having with MySQL as well was updating the indexes. So if you've got, this project is essentially been a big production process, and you're processing these large data sets, and you're sending them through evaluation when you've done the NLP, and we needed a solution whereby, if something, say for example, the evaluation didn't spot something. I mean, evaluation of NLP and that sort of thing is very subjective. I mean, it's basically the views of historians and our users. What constitutes a name in a 17th century data set? I mean, how do you classify the bishop of such and such a place, for heaven's sake? We needed a solution that would enable us if in say five months' time we discover that there's a major problem with a data set, we're going to need to re-index it. So we're having to store this stuff at different stages, and we need to be able to take those indexes out of the system, reprocess and plug them back in. With MySQL, we were finding that we weren't able to do that without having to do the whole lot, and we're talking like vast amounts of time to do this. Whereas with Lucene, we discovered that apart from the fact that it was faster, and it gave us the structured as well as the full text searchability, it also enabled us to essentially plug in and revise indexes, so we can deal with the indexes separately. So there are indexes per resource, and if we need to update the index for a resource, we can do that without having to reload
the whole the whole
thing, because obviously as a service growing, you know, it needs to be scalable, because over time, I mean, it's already, you know, it's already sort of a significant resource that's becoming you know, rapidly unmanageable. So
can I also ask whether any of the data sets you're dealing with are things which are themselves growing and changing, so that you need to periodically refresh the data set that you're acquiring?
Yeah, there are some. Some projects. I think there's probably only about two or three where the data set will change. As I said, originally we'd had the idea of using a web crawler to be able to pull this data down. What we're going to do now is, one, keep in touch with the content providers, and we've realised that maintaining the relationship with all your stakeholders, you know, way into the future is absolutely critical. But also we're going to use the web crawler simply to identify when changes have taken place. But the web crawler won't actually deliver the text to us. We'll use the, we'll then actually go and say to the content provider, if they haven't already told us, we think your data's changed. If it has, can we have another set, and we'll update it. It was about 700 gig of text. So yeah, it's quite big. Whereas some of the data sets have been, say, you know, less than 100 megabytes. So putting in place something that enables, yeah, because like obviously with his historical resources, there's, you know, you can't say that, you know, there's only value in the vast data sets that you get provided by the British Library, etc. So we've had to put in place a solution that you know, sort of accommodates all those different times. Okay.
Thank you.